Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Hey folks, a quick word of explanation about what you're about to hear. These podcasts are an edit of what happens in our live gatherings at the table. And sometimes our live gatherings are very live. In this particular case, in an adjacent room, the kids' table crowd, the younger members of our community, were interviewing one of the adults from the community. And it got really lively and kind of noisy over there in delightful, engaged ways. And some of that leaked into the recording in our space. So this might be a little bit of a challenge to listen to. I've done what I can to mitigate that, but it's still, there's some joyful noise in the background. I hope you can see your way past that and still attend to the ideas here, because I think they are important to more of us than know that they are important to us. We're learning about this as we go. Enjoy, and thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. A couple of years ago, I tore down an old wood rail fence that was on our yard that was there when we bought the place. Since that fence had been built, and it's probably, I'm guessing, but that fence was probably 2 or 3 decades old, at least. Since it had been built, a number of trees had grown up, both sort of around and even sort of within it. And it was, for me at least, it was both a bit sad, and it was also quite remarkable to see how the trees had formed themselves around things that wouldn't move out of their way. The power of a growing tree to move things is kind of astonishing, but also in this case, they'd formed right around rails. And perhaps that experience is part of why I was so struck by what I'm about to read to you. This is from a book by Peter Levine. Levine is one of the leading experts on trauma recovery and healing. The book is called Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma and the Innate Capacity to Transform Overwhelming Experiences. So the subtitle gives his game away pretty thoroughly, if you're sort of paying attention to the word innate in there especially. But he writes this: when a young tree is injured, it grows around its injury. That's the rub about wild and living things. They respond to their environment honestly. Our bodies are alive and wild and honest, and the ways they grow so tenaciously around the wounds of the past is the rhythm of nature, a thing of great beauty. In the internal and external symptoms of trauma are the very energies, potentials, and resources necessary for their healing and transformation. The both-and-ness of that is really potent. And I wanted to share it at the beginning of our time together, in part because we're about to wade into a talky bit that will necessarily be a little bit more technical than some, and in which we have to traverse some difficult ideas, I would say, maybe to see hope on the other side. So I wanted to start here. I wanted to start with the reminder, as Levine says, that within you, within me, are the energies, the potentials, and the resources necessary for healing and transformation. It's obviously a complex idea, not least of all because it doesn't necessarily feel that way, right? Now, if you've been following along in this series, and if I've done my work with any semblance of competency, one of the themes that you will have encountered several times is that in belief systems that create the conditions for probable trauma, the message inside of those systems that is repeatedly sent is more or less the opposite of what I just read. The message that is repeatedly sent inside of those systems is this message: The resources you need to be whole are not within you, and there is no hope that they ever will be. And that's part of the problem, systemically. This kind of idea, the resources for wholeness are not within you, that's what follows logically on being taught doctrines like original sin, which characterizes all humans as inherently flawed, and notions like eternal punishment, which teach that we're never fully safe from the potential wrath of an all-powerful, all-seeing deity. There's no escape. And that's without factoring in teachings like Judgment Day, the Rapture, so on. So in many settings as well, another factor is that those teachings are issued within and they're controlled by a variety of fear-based teaching strategies, including, you know, threats of damnation. If that feels like it glosses over a lot, and it might, I would encourage you to go back and listen to the podcasts of part one and two, which aren't exhaustive, but they do go into more detail on that stuff. There's another important academic work related to this topic, a book by Dr. Paul Martin that's entitled The Healing Mind. And in that book, Martin tells the story of a series of missile attacks against Israel during the Gulf War. And just to head off our partisan trained thinking, this is, in Martin's context and in this context, this isn't a political story, it's a human trauma story. In this series of attacks, a large number of Israeli citizens died. And one of the things that is curious about these deaths, something inside of me balks at just that sentence. It feels like a thing to be other than curious about. But also, one of the things that is curious about these deaths is that the vast majority of them did not occur, during all the attacks, did not occur because of any direct physical impact from the missiles themselves. The majority of the victims of those attacks died on the first day of the attacks. And they died from heart failure due to stress, anxiety, and fear that was brought on by the sense of the impending doom of this series of attacks. It was the world that was created by fear, a world where they were suddenly required to live. They had to be there. They had to live in it. It was their world, but they had to live in it against their power or will, and it was that fear that brought the level of harm to their minds and ultimately to their bodies that killed them. So what brought the most harm was not the missiles, but the emotional response to the potential harm. In fact, in terms of the statistics, no one was killed by the missiles themselves on day one. And yet, in that whole series of attacks, that was the day that had the highest death toll. Not a single one from a direct missile hit. The power of perceived threat by way of psychological trauma sets the stage for, among other things, the development of dissociation, PTSD, complex PTSD, and what we've been calling religious trauma syndrome. And when it comes to the way trauma works, that is no less true for someone indoctrinated by fear-based teachings than it is for citizens wondering if the next missile is going to be the one with their name on it. Now, I just used a string of specific terms that we might benefit by defining, and I did say we're going to be a little bit more technical today, this is a little bit more teachery. So I don't know that I need to feel apologetic about that, but I do want to say it. So here we go. If this is already familiar to you, then I hope the review is helpful. If it's not, and you feel like you're losing track of some of these concepts because the language or the ideas are unfamiliar, I would say be kind to yourself if you're able. It can take a while for a lot of these ideas to sort of settle in and feel like they're intuitive, and there's some reasons for that. Not the least of the reasons is because the terms themselves, in terms of the cultural discourse, are relatively new. And also because some of them run across the grain of ways of thinking about what it means to be human that some of us have been taught, and some that have become so pervasive, some notions of what it means and how we function as humans, some of them become so pervasive that they just form the background of wider cultural assumptions about what it means to be human and how we work as humans. So there are these huge sort of themes in our shared understanding of what it means to be a human being that are being reinformed as we learn about what we try to capture with the language of trauma. And having said that, I would add that the science is substantial. There's lots of ways to learn about this, if you want to. I can point you to the academic works that I'm referencing as I prepare this, if you're interested in reading the original material and so on. Anyway, bit of a primer today on trauma in general, as well as PTSD and complex PTSD, and really primer level. And I'll just touch on today how those relate to religious trauma syndrome. We'll get into that more in the days ahead. As I think I've told this story here before, but as a Newcastle cabbie once said to my kids when they were late getting us to a train. Buckle up, kids. So we're going to cover a fair bit of ground in a short time here. But we will also come back to lots of these concepts to consider them from other perspectives as the series moves along. So, like, don't be concerned if all these ideas don't land or stick on the first pass if they're new. All right, a bit of religious context, because ultimately that's sort of the wider frame for our particular consideration here. There is a clearly identifiable trend in religion on this continent at present, the short version of which is that adherence to it is shrinking. And I won't bother with the stats in this setting. They're easy to find if you want the numbers, and there's lots of different perspectives from which this has been surveyed, so there's lots of data out there if you want data. But perhaps one of the compelling questions that comes out of a trend like that is why? And now, depending on your personal experience, you might be like, why not, right? But also, why? Why, when there's a trend, what's the driver? And I think there's lots of things we could point to. I think we could rightly point to changing political, culture, and social landscapes. For sure, all those are big pieces of this puzzle. And we could also, and this one doesn't come up in the discourse as often, but I think we could also legitimately point to a growing awareness in the general population of what trauma is and what its manifestations and effects are. As people become more equipped to identify their personal psychological and physiological experiences within the definitions, the clinical and technical definitions of trauma, they become more able to recognize their own symptoms and triggers. They're also becoming more able to pay attention to their intuitive wisdom, Levine's idea that the resources are within us, telling them to seek safety, to leave authoritarian, abusive, and traumatic institutions and structures. We're getting language for this. We're getting shared ideas for these experiences. And that's part of equipping us to respond in more healthy, more helpful ways to them. I think this intersection is one way to make sense of how many people that were regular church attendees never went back after the pandemic, for instance. You might know that that old folk saying, you can't see the forest for the trees. I mean, we're creatures of habit. And there's something helpful about that, of course, that we shortcut all kinds of things. Through habit, it's one of the ways we survive and navigate life. Some of us need them more than others. I identify with needing them more maybe than some. Sometimes what happens, the forest and trees part of this, is that sometimes what happens is when we choose to step away from what we're familiar with, or when we are compelled to step away from it, we get a different perspective on whatever was habitual. We kind of make space for a reconsideration. One of the tenets of adult learning is that the storage shelf is full, generally speaking, that to learn something new, we have to displace something that's already there. Like, that disruption is part of learning and change. And so when I think about a widely dispersed disruptive event, like the pandemic, and I think about this trend of people leaving organized religion, and I think about the added information of what constitutes trauma and how can we identify its impact in ourselves and how might we connect that to our religious and institutional experiences of religion, I think about that intersection and I think, okay, we've got the disruption, we've got the different perspective, we've got the new information. To me, at least, it doesn't feel like a huge surprise that for some folks it's been like, seen from this vantage point, that's not something I should go back to. Time for change. And statistically, that change equals changing the adherence, right? It equals leaving an institution. And so sometimes in those intersections, we find ourselves having these moments of realization, these aha moments where the internal language is something like, I couldn't see it then, but now I can see it. And having seen it, I can't unsee it. Now what do I do? Right? So one of the pieces of information that I've referred to generally that's making its way into the wider conversation is what I've referred to over the last few weeks as religious trauma syndrome. For those of you that have a little bit more of a clinical frame, this is not a clinical diagnosis. It's other matters related to, if you look in the DSM, but it is there listed as an attendant trauma to PTSD and complex PTSD. That's what it's attached to. So, as this idea that we're going to kind of unpack here becomes known to more people, folks are having those kind of moments that I described. They're having moments where they finally have language for what they've experienced or perhaps what they are experiencing. And for many, having that language, having those concepts is just an incredible it's not just this, but it's also an incredible relief in body, mind, and spirit to learn what their experiences have a name, that they have some definition, and that also they have some commonality with the experiences of others. I'm not alone in this. And when you talk, when I talk with these folks who've had or are having these kind of experiences, that sense of I thought it was just me, and discovering that it wasn't just me. Whew, I thought this was all in my head, which is an interesting phrase in itself. It can be all in your head and be your whole life experience, folks. It gets into your body. I bumped into this saying, which some of you might be familiar with this past week, that when we sweep an emotion under the rug, we sweep it into our nervous system. Anyway, right? So that all in my head is, you know, touches on some of those things. But people just kind of going, it's not just me. And it's not even just me and some other, I use this term in gigantic quotes, it's not just me and some other crazy folks, right? Like there's substance to this. There's other ways to look at it from the outside and see that it's a thing. So the reification of the experience, if you will, the thingification of it, the naming of it, is important. And also, beyond that, there is sometimes this attendant realization that they or we don't have to return to those systems, to those institutions, to those communities where we have had traumatic experiences, which might have been an impossible thought without that information. All right. With some of those very human stories in view, onto a few details. When we talk about religious trauma syndrome, which I'm just going to call RTS going forward because we're going to have a whole bunch of terms here in a moment, we're talking about a relatively new clinical diagnosis. The term itself was coined by Dr. Marlene Winnell in 2011 and showed up in terms of the academic literature, shows up for the first time in an article in the British Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Psychotherapies. The phenomenon, in terms of lived experience, was recognized long before that, but Winnell gave it a name, as these things tend to go in fields like this. And Winnell explains the importance of naming the syndrome as being similar to her illustration is naming anorexia as a disorder. She's like, the label can lessen shame and isolation for survivors. It can also promote diagnosis, treatment, training for professionals who work with people that are suffering from that condition or as named that syndrome. So in very much in brief here, and I'm leaving out so much, as is always the case with complicated and emerging ideas, but I want to give us somewhere to start. So in brief, RTS describes psychological distress from, in particular, authoritarian dogmatic religions involving indoctrination, harm, and leaving a controlling group. And it leads to symptoms like anxiety, low self-worth, difficulty trusting, shattered worldviews, often resembles complex PTSD and its symptoms, but it's linked, hence the name, it's linked directly to experiences in religious context or religious experiences. All right, so that's the linkage, hence the religious part of this. So as I said, not a DSM diagnosis, but recognized concept for clinicians that are helping people who, especially that are working to exit those harmful faith environments and healing involving at the sort of professional, clinical, or therapeutic level, therapy, but also just more generally rebuilding self-trust and redefining spirituality, right? What do I believe? As we mentioned earlier, this is most likely to show up in contexts where people are taught that they are inherently flawed and unsafe, sinful, facing a wrathful God's judgment. Those are the big doctrines. And symptoms can span cognitive confusion, anxiety, depression, sexual dysfunction, substance abuse, social isolation, developmental delays that are caused by restricting critical thinking and information control, right? So there's quite a range of symptoms that can show up under this label. And in slightly more technical terms, I've alluded to this, but RTS can easily be compared to sort of a combination of PTSD and complex PTSD. As a general idea in our society, as our understanding of how trauma works has grown, one of the realizations is that trauma is an impactful psychophysical experience, even if, and this is really important as it relates to religious trauma syndrome, even if the original event or ongoing experience does not necessarily threaten to cause bodily harm. And this is one of the things that's been sort of problematic about the language of trauma. We already had the language of trauma. We used it for physical harm, blunt force trauma. Who hasn't seen that show up in CSI? You know what I mean? Like we kind of have a use for that word already. But as we've used that same term for this, it's sort of like it's become vernacular, right? How was your day at school? It was traumatic. How are we using the word, right? And so we kind of have to be a little bit careful with it. But in this context, when we're talking about this understanding of trauma, this realization that the original event, the ongoing experience, doesn't have to threaten bodily harm to be trauma. Because a lot of this comes down to the individual's experience. So Peter Levine, whom I referred to at the beginning, simply says that, quote, trauma need not be obviously traumatizing to be traumatic. Right, so this is a really important idea when we start to think about the subtle ways in which a religious doctrine or environment might actually be traumatizing. All right? It's an important piece of the puzzle because many of the experiences that form the basis for religious trauma syndrome, might look pretty benign from the outside, or they could be ones we could easily discount or dismiss if they've happened to us. So from both sides of this, from the authority side, somebody's like, I was traumatized by this and that in my religious experience. Religious authorities can pretty easily say, and what was the experience? And when you talk about what the experience was, I went to church and somebody was teaching me things. They're like, that doesn't look like trauma to me. Trauma looks like this. And you pick a really egregious illustration of a traumatic event and you dismiss the person's trauma, right? Because it doesn't match that. And so that's why this part of the puzzle is really important. Trauma, in the end, is determined by how the body responds to an incident, not to the actual incident itself. So very individual. There's big ideas here, but also deeply individual. So both objective and subjective, if you want to use that kind of language. We're going to come back to how all of that connects to RTS another day. But because RTS is a form of PTSD, I want us to have a little bit of a basic understanding of how PTSD works going forward. Now, blizzard of terms. So when we're facing a threat as a human being, and a threat is whatever we're experiencing as a threat, very individual. One person's threat is another person's woohoo. There's a real range here. What happens is basically in terms of the brain stuff is that the brain signals the autonomic nervous system. We're just going to call that ANS. We'll give us some terms here. All right. So it signals the autonomic nervous system, which is comprised of the sympathetic nervous system. And that primes us for fight or flight, and also the parasympathetic nervous system, which helps to lower the heart rate and the breathing rate. So kind of like one part that steps on the gas and another part that steps on the brakes. If you go upstairs and talk to Camille, who's training, the barista, who's training to be a massage therapist, she's like, I want to get people into a parasympathetic state as a massage therapist. I want that relaxed, slower. I want the volume turned down, right? If trauma is prolonged and the particular body involved or being exposed to this can't or simply doesn't choose to fight or to flee, that often results in sort of a third maladaptive response, which is freeze. For the more detail inclined, that's basically when the limbic system activates both the SNS and the PNS and it immobilizes the body. That's really short shrift, but there you go. For folks who like to be current or for those who just like blizzards of acronyms, fight, flight, freeze, there's two more Fs these days, fawn and flop. Flop, this is technically collapse, but flop is easier to remember because it fits in with all the Fs, right? So we won't get into those. We're going to stick with those basic ones. So I'll leave it to look them up if you want. But the three that we've already mentioned are at the heart of the strongest responses, and those are driven by some of the oldest and the fastest acting parts of our brain. That stuff happens without any input from us in terms of the conscious part of our experience. Now, none of what I just described is PTSD, okay? Just to be clear. What I just described is our body's natural response to threat. We are made for this. And it happens without us thinking about it. However, and this is a big however, we're wired to have those experiences like a sprint, not like a marathon. We're wired for that stuff to kick in, equip us for the threat, deal with the threat. We'll talk a little bit more about that and how it can get stuck, and then have that go back down to whatever our baseline is. PTSD is the complex psychobiological condition that emerges in the wake of a perceived life-threatening experience when the psychological and physiological stress responses persist long after the traumatic event has expired. They just keep on coming. So people with PTSD often have, I won't auger into this too much, but they often have lower cortisol levels in their body, which suggests that their adrenal glands weren't able to release enough cortisol to halt the alarm reaction during an ANS activation when they're experiencing threat. So it's keeps going, essentially. So in a book called by Babette Rothschild called The Body Remembers, The Psychophysiology of Trauma and Trauma Treatment, Rothschild says that most often PTSD develops in an individual in response to three types of events. And I want to, because this is fairly, again, abbreviated in a lot of ways, it captures a lot, we're going to see the crossover here in a moment. So Rothschild says these events are incidents that are or are perceived as threatening to one's own life or bodily integrity, witnessing acts of violence to others, sometimes hearing of violence to or the expected or violent death of close associates, which is just fancy language for someone we know. Now, you might find yourself thinking that these criteria don't apply to any of your religious experience, or you might already be making connections between being taught as a child that one of your two possible futures includes endlessly burning and never burning up, which is a violent image by any criteria, and how that sort of imagery clearly overlaps with two of the three types of events that are outlined there. And a range of experiences everywhere in between, right? I had a conversation earlier this week with a friend who recalled being at some church events with a traveling evangelist who told the group that unless they went to Africa, this story's littered with problematic ideas, so just stay with me. Unless they went to Africa to save the people there, their eternal fate, the people in the room, unless they went and saved these other people, their fate was to burn in hell. And my friend remembers thinking, they were 9 at the time, remembers thinking, that doesn't make any sense. And when they asked their mom about it, she just nodded her head in agreement because in her family environment, she couldn't out loud agree with them. But she agreed. That didn't make any sense. She remembers this. So we were out on the deck, and she was just leaning on the rail of the deck, looking out into the yard. Said if she was a smoker, she would have been like, you know, she was contemplating this. And he says, I came out to the deck, and I stood beside her, and I said, Mom, that doesn't make any sense. And he said, she just looked at me, and she went, whole story. But even within those constraints, my friend now had a trusted ally who could at least acknowledge the problem. They weren't alone with the problem. Which brings us to the last piece of this that we're going to touch on today. And this won't take us all the way through the process of explaining the connection between PTSD and RTS, but it'll give us a bit of a start. What's becoming increasingly clear is that one of the main factors in determining whether a traumatic event turns into PTSD is whether or not dissociation occurs during that event. And that is, again, broad brushing here, but that is because dissociation directly correlates with the deployment of the freeze response in the face of threat. When the body freezes, rather than fighting or fleeing, it's not able to release the internal energy that builds up inside of it during that moment where the internal alarm sounds and ANS is activated. There's an incredible amount of energy that gets released in those experiences. And that's normal and healthy. The limbic system should activate ANS the moment the threat is perceived. If you want a mechanistic metaphor, that means the machinery is working. It's doing what it should. But when the ANS continues to be aroused once the threat is passed, that energy, and again, it's hard to find language even, but that energy remains trapped and stagnant within the body. It's stuck. And when that happens, it can feel to the individual like the traumatic event exists outside of time. It's perceived as still being in the present rather than in the past. So trauma and stress, traumatic events and stress are meant to go together, but they're not meant to be stuck together ongoing. And because of that, when that gets stuck, the trauma is basically prevented from occupying its proper position in the past. It doesn't feel over. And that sensory experience of this isn't over, that's at the heart of what we call PTSD. Now, again, big themes here, so much information in the background, but and an entry point for us. So ultimately, the two factors that determine trauma are the response to the event and whether or not the body was able to seek an energetic resolution by way of that response, not the nature of the event itself. It's the stuckness of the energy that makes this trauma. As we learn more about all of this, I think one of the things that becomes clearer is that any potentially traumatizing event, whether it's real or imagined, I use those terms advisedly, may result in the same physiological responses indicative of PTSD. In other words, you don't necessarily need to physically experience a place of eternal conscious torment to be traumatized. Being told it exists and imagining what it could be like may suffice. And when we're exposed to these things as children, in particular, because we're pretty concrete at a lot of those stages, right? No, nothing inside of our child brain is like, I think I'm hearing a metaphor. Like, that's not what's going on in there, right? That's a literal place, and my literal bestie from school who doesn't believe what I've been told is the truth, that's where they're going. One of the most important insights, I think, to come out of a big study, this was 96, 97, I think, Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. You can look it up if you want. Lots of information about it. Was the discovery that when an individual has spent formative developmental years in an environment that is causing them to live in a state of fear, whatever that might be, and here we're sort of talking about the religious version of that, but big net, they tend to dissociate or freeze in the face of threat. And they're doing that in order to survive the experience of having to stay in that environment. It's a way to cope. And when someone experiences fear but has no permission or opportunity to express it, to discharge that energy or to seek safety from it, they are highly likely, some would say, I mean, some of the literature I read used the word certain, to develop and experience complex PTSD. So strong emphasis here. There's a lot here to work with already, but I want to just offer two thoughts to kind of close this particular, again, information-heavy talky bit. If you or I grew up in a setting where the surrounding subculture encouraged and even enforced the suppression of most emotions, and we perceived or experienced that we were not free to leave that environment, which would be the norm for most children, right? That we're dependent, then we're in a situation where we don't feel like we can escape from teachings that feel threatening. And when you're a kid or a vulnerable adult, there can be truly nowhere to run or hide from what you're told is an eternal reality, an unchangeable inner nature, or an all-seeing God. And when it comes to PTSD, or as we'll consider next time, religious trauma syndrome, it's kind of the perfect storm. If I was going to try to put it in a sentence, it kind of goes like this. There's nowhere you can hide from God. And if you don't believe this exact set of beliefs that can save you from the inclination to wrath and punishment that's inherent to that God, then you are destined for eternal suffering. And if you choose not to believe this, you'll not only face that forever, but also, if you push back, you're going to lose your community in the present. It's not that hard to see the possible connections, is it? Which is why religious trauma syndrome includes both being exposed to those things and trying to leave communities that are operating that way. Those are sort of the two big bundles. And also, I didn't mention this explicitly, but vulnerable communities, adult communities, sort of have their own unique place in this, and in particular, adult communities in the LGBTQ plus communities, where people have been told your identity actually condemns you to these fates. That's pretty grim. I think that's fair. But it's also not the whole story. And I don't want to gloss the difficulty of any of this, and also I want it to have a little rounder context if I can. You remember that bit at the beginning where I talked about the tree growing around the wound? If you took one of those off the tree and you put it on a lathe and you hollowed it out so you could see what was happening inside of it, that's what you would see. You still see you can see the wound. You can see the scar. But the beauty as well, right? Just astonishingly beautiful. That's a birch burl. My dad used to have a deal with the local loggers. See, birch burl, if you're a free market capitalist who happens to work in the logging industry, a birch burl screws up your nice clean grain timber. It's a problem. That tree is diseased. If you're an artist who works on a lathe, that's not how you see that burl at all, right? You're like, you just lop that off that tree, toss it in the back of your truck, and bring it to me. And I'm going to make one of these, and I'll make you a pair of candlestick holders as well. Deal? Deal. My dad had a shed full of birch burls that he turned into things like this. Our bodies are alive and wild and honest, and the ways they grow so tenaciously around the wounds of the past is the rhythm of nature, a thing of great beauty. In the internal and external symptoms of trauma, inside the burl, if you will, are the very energies, potentials, and resources necessary for their healing and transformation. The same systems we've been considering, the same things we're trying to put language around here, when they aren't blocked or stuck, contain the very energies that we need to heal from trauma, to get past the things that we might describe as maladaptive, the burl from the logger's point of view, our functionality from the broader society's point of view, perhaps. And to get in there and hollow that out or whatever. I don't like the hollowing part, but to make visible the beauty and the energy and the potential for healing and wholeness. How that might take place or what can help us even consider some of those possibilities, that's something that we're going to move into considering in the coming weeks. But for now, my invitation to us would be to leave this as we began it. Reminded of the wonder that each of us are and how uniquely we're equipped to heal from even wounds that we presently experience as profoundly painful. We'll keep on exploring. Peace.